Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Produce Buzzers Podcast. We are so happy you have joined us today, and I think you will be too after the show is over, because you will learn a lot about fresh fruits and vegetables, how to select and store them, how to prepare and cook them, and surprising facts about their history and origin. We hope it inspires you to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables, not only for your health, but also for your delight and pleasure as you explore their amazing world of taste and delicious flavors. Eating more of them will transform your life in so many positive ways. So settle back, relax, and get ready for another delicious adventure with the Produce Buzzers. Welcome to another episode of Produce Buzzers Podcast. I'm your host, Edwin Stepp, executive editor of producebuzz.com. And as usual, I'm joined by Teresa Nolan, the president and founder of Produce Buzz, along with Rick Stepp and Cynthia Benedetto, both contributing editors to Produce Buzz. Produce Buzzers podcast fans, we have a very, very special guest joining us today on the podcast. Our guest has studied and researched for years how what we eat affects our health. He is arguably the world's foremost expert on inflammation, and especially on how what we eat can contribute to increasing or decreasing inflammation in our bodies. We're going to ask him what he's learned from those decades of research on the subject, and specifically how eating more fresh fruits and vegetables is key in fighting it. Our guest today is Dr. James Hebert, a professor at the University of South Carolina in Columbia, South Carolina. Dr. Hebert's professional focus has been on developing and refining a tool he calls the Dietary Inflammatory Index, or DII. Since 1988, Dr. Hebert has led research on 52 federal grants with budgets totaling approximately $84 million. He has published over 840 peer-reviewed papers in high-impact medical journals, with most of them focusing on various aspects of diet on health. Dr. Hebert's primary administrative role at the University of South Carolina is director of the Cancer Prevention and Control Program. And his new book, Diet, Inflammation, and Health, will be published by Elsevier Amsterdam and New York soon in 2022. Dr. Hebert's primary academic appointment at the university is in the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics in the Arnold School of Public Health of the University of South Carolina. He also holds adjunct appointments in the Department of Family and Preventive Medicine and the U.S. School of Medicine, and in the Department of Medicine at the Medical University of South Carolina, which is in Charleston, I believe. That's not in Columbia, correct? Yes. Dr. Hebert has established strong collaborations around the world in the areas of public health, cancer prevention and control, and epidemiology and biostatistics as a nutritional and cancer epidemiologist. Over the past decade, Dr. Hebert spent considerable effort developing the DII, which has now been established as an effective research tool and translated to a suite of products to guide individuals on a path to improved health outcomes. Early in 2013, he founded Connecting Health Innovations, LLC, and currently serves as president, scientific director, and chair of nutrition. It is through CHI, Connecting Health Innovations, CHI, that much of the work to make the DII the basis of a better health takes place. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Hebert. Such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Looking forward to answering your questions.
Now, you've got quite a resume, and the science. We don't talk a lot about science on the Produce Buzzers podcast, but obviously, you know, we reference certain studies, and you know, we're trying to encourage people to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables, which is not everything that you delve into, but certainly a key part of what you're finding in your research and how that helps our health. So, you know, we try to have a little fun with it, not get too bogged down in the science, but the science is very important in convincing people, I think, to eat better, eat more fresh fruits and vegetables. Well, to start off, tell us about your career, how you came to focus on dietary inflammation.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I grew up in a relatively rural area. We had a large scale garden. And when I was very young, we preserved a lot of our own foods. In fact, until recently, I had my parents' canning pressure cooker. So that was one of my earliest memories, was actually growing the food and participating with the family and helping to preserve food. So food was a really important part of my life growing up. And one of the things that I noticed, which was kind of interesting, was that I'd get injured a lot because I was a very active kid and I was always outdoors. If the sun or the moon was out, I'd just be outside and I'd get injured. And what I noticed, which was really fascinating, was that my injuries would heal at the end of the summer and early fall more quickly than at other times of the year. And this was noticeable to me. This is something I paid attention to. We moved from that area to a more rural area when I was in the fourth grade.
Where were you? Where did you grow up?
This was in Connecticut, in Hartford County, Connecticut, in the Connecticut Valley, which has some of the richest soil. It's aggravating to grow food there because there are so many rocks mixed in with the soil, but it's riverine soil. It's extremely rich. So the topsoil was, you know, between a foot and 2 feet deep. And it was this dark, rich loam. It was just wonderful. And all you had to do was pluck the rocks out and put the, you know, easier said than done.
Yeah, right.
And so we moved from that area to a more rural area, but the canning and preserving actually kind of fell by the wayside relatively quickly because my mother started her own business in Hartford, and she just wasn't participating in it. Without her, you know, taking the lead with the canning, that it just didn't happen. So we continued to have a big garden and I continued to participate in that. But before leaving the first town, I recall my fourth grade teacher, Mr. Taylor. It was unusual to have a male teacher in those days. It probably still is. But he said something that just stuck in my head. And it was, he said, you know, if you get irritated by a belt, and I remember this image really quickly, there's a chance you could get cancer there. I went, I didn't even know what cancer was at the time, but I knew it wasn't good. And I thought, that's really interesting. And I put it in the back of my mind. So I filed that away. And I was always drawn to science and math. And it never really dawned on me in those days that you could connect nutrition to science and math. And of course, you can. I mean, you know, all of the building blocks that we're made of, ultimately, except for oxygen, comes from the stuff we put in our mouth, the food. So understanding how nutrients interact, how they create protein, fat, you know, and all the other things in our bodies, you know, is all about science. I mean, that just went right over my head. So I ultimately, after graduating from college in 1967, now I'm dating myself, I decided that I would, you know, rather than go into academics, go into business. So I went to Colorado. I formed a construction company with a friend of mine from college. And I ended up selling that business in 1970, well, right before Carter was elected. So that would have been 1976. And then I went off to India. And before leaving, I applied to graduate school. And I decided, I got in every place I applied. And I decided, well, the place I should go, it's the place with the worst weather, because I would be more apt to be indoors. I wouldn't want to go outdoors play and see it. So
that's wisdom.
I'm interested in food. I mean, the food, and I'm leaving for India to go on sabbatical next week, as we've discussed. And just the word India makes my mouth water. I mean, it's just, I love the food there. So it was a, I was realizing that my academic trajectory could intersect with food at some point. But it still would be a couple more decades before I connected to inflammation. So I went from India to graduate school and then on to working for the UN for a couple of years. And then I came back and I worked at the American Health Foundation for a guy by the name of Ernie Winder, who wrote the first paper on smoking on lung cancer. And he was obsessed about nutrition. So he hired me to really head up their nutritional epidemiology program. And I was there for 3.5 years, then went to UMass Medical School, where I was for 10 years, and then came here to South Carolina. And when I came here, one of the things that drew me was the cancer research. I had always been interested in cancer as a research topic. And there was a cadre of people who were really interested in inflammation and focusing particularly on colorectal cancer, which of all the cancers is the most strongly related to inflammation. So that's how it happened.
Oh, very good. And where when you applied for grad school, what was the emphasis in your studies? Was it
Environmental health.
okay,
I'm
environmental health, right?
really
Okay.
interested in environmental health sciences.
And where was the worst weather for grad school?
Oh, Seattle.
Oh, Seattle.
Without a doubt,
Yeah.
it did not disappoint me. I mean, it was
I
every
think.
night I go, I look up and I can see the stars, and every day it would rain, and it was
I think
so.
Rick might. I don't know if there's. I'm sure there's grad schools in Duluth. Rick lives in Duluth,
Oh
Minnesota.
yeah,
And I think that might be top Seattle, but probably didn't have the curriculum you were looking for.
We actually have a medical school at the University of Minnesota Duluth.
Well, I needed a school of public health, so this was very important to me. And there, in those days, I don't know how many schools of public health there are now, maybe 70, 80. In those days, there were a little over 30. So there were not a lot to choose from. And so that's where I wound up. And then
Could I ask you a question?
yes, please.
When did you first go to Columbia, South Carolina? What approximately what year?
1999.
Did you know Dr. Bill Woods?
Oh yeah, no, Bill Woods.
He was my son's leukemia doctor at the University of Minnesota. My son got leukemia at age 4.
I know Bill. Bill's a great guy.
I notice he's at Emory now, where we lived in Atlanta when he first got leukemia, and he's at Emory University, where we took our son when he first was diagnosed. So,
Right.
and
Yeah,
he's
Bill.
doing research, I think, on cancer.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah. I don't stay in close touch with him, but you know, he was a sort of a mentor to me when I came here. He was the director of the Cancer Center, and I came as the chair of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics. So we worked pretty closely together over those few years when he was here.
That's great because he was a great doctor. My son survived it. He's still in remission, and
Perfect.
he's in the air. He's a pilot in the Air Force now.
Great.
So he was a
That's
great
great.
doctor.
Small world. Fantastic. No, that's great to hear. That's very interesting.
Excuse
Yeah.
me.
Go ahead.
Why did you ever figure out if your belt was too tight, why you'd get cancer?
Oh, yeah. Well, it wasn't just the
Question.
tightness of the belt, but it was the chafing of the belt. So
It was the what?
the chafing, you know, the
Okay.
irritation. I think you're going to ask me some questions about what inflammation is, and perhaps I can, elaborate at that point.
Okay,
Go
yeah.
ahead.
Well, why don't can you give us your best and most, I'm going to say concise, but don't worry about being concise. We have plenty of time. You might not, but your best and most concise definition of inflammation, and then what it means for our health.
Well, inflammation from the perspective of your experience of it, and we can talk more about the biology, which is important to your experience of it, but your experience of it is the proximal, most relevant, important thing. And it's characterized by four things, basically: warmth, heat, And that makes sense because inflammation refers to heat, of course. So that's one of the four signs. Pain, redness, and swelling. And then some people would put a fifth category in there, and that would be, for lack of a better word, dysfunction, where if it's really severe, you can no longer think, you can no longer move. So it's basically, you know, really potentially very debilitating. But the but those are the main four signs of inflammation.
What was after heat before redness?
Swelling and pain. So there's redness, warmth, and pain.
And as I understand it, mostly from talking to you and reading what you've written, this is the body's healthy reaction to some kind of problem in the body.
Yes, that initially, that's exactly right. So what I like to tell my students is, you know, were it not for you having the ability to mount an inflammatory response, you'd be dead in about 2 weeks. So you need to mount this this inflammatory response because you're exposed to viruses, as we now are very well aware, bacteria, cuts, abrasions, and spontaneous mutations. So this is an interesting fact. So the inflammatory response, the initial inflammatory response, is really one and the same as the innate immune response. And it happens literally in a nanosecond. I mean, a tiny fraction of a second. So if you were to, you know, cut yourself, you'd see and feel what's going on virtually immediately. And all of the cytokine messengers, all the things that would recruit the different cells of the immune system to come to the site of injury, would happen instantaneously. And another really interesting fact is some of those things are outside dangers, you know, things coming from outside your body. But we also produce over a trillion mutations a day, over a trillion per day, just in the normal biological machinery of cells turning over.
Interesting. And well, how many, what was that? A million, over a million, or how many million?
Trillion.
A trillion.
It's a million million.
Wow.
It's a million million mutations a day.
Wow.
More than a million million mutations a day.
Yeah.
So in some of those mutations are throwaway mutations. They're, you know, they render the biological product, which is just not viable. You know, it's just,
is that the majority of them or just?
Yeah, the vast majority. Yeah,
right.
There's a minority that are going to become cancer. And it is that innate immune system, which is characterized by the natural killer cells. And natural killer cells are cells in the immune system that don't require prior sensitization. So what they do is they detect these cell membrane proteins as foreign, and that's good enough for them. So they will glom on to the cell, and they'll drill a hole in it, and the antigenic stuff will leak out. And it is the leaking out of the antigenic stuff, if there's a lot of it, you know, if you have a really bad infection, for example, that causes a fever. And a fever is related to inflammation, hence the word heat, and, you know, and so on and so forth. So this innate immune system is bloody brilliant. It turns on instantaneously, and it turns off usually within about 96 hours.
That's fascinating.
Are you getting close to a point where you can prescribe a diet that's targeted at certain kinds of cancers, or is it just the low inflammatory diet will help any type of cancer?
I think that's a really great question. I think we're at the point in history where we're going to be transitioning to precision medicine, precision nutrition recommendations. But I don't think we're there yet. And I don't think we need to worry about it much yet, because the other part of your question implied that we do have a good public health prescription that would apply to healthfulness in general and cancer prevention and control in particular. without worrying about a particular cancer. Now, people may be sensitive to particular food items, for example, the nightshades. So, you know, there are some people who are, I'm sensitive to eggplants, for example. Yeah. I don't seem to be very sensitive to other nightshades, but nightshades.
What happens if you eat it?
Oh, I get arthritic pains in my hands.
Just for our listeners, I think probably most of them know what nightshades are, but that's a certain family of plants. The eggplant, as Dr. Hebert mentioned, tomatoes. Right. What are some of the others? I should know these. I knew them.
Peppers, New World peppers. Tobacco would be in that group as well. Oh, yeah. Belladonna, you know, right. would be in that group. Potatoes.
That was a big one.
They're all New World crops.
Right.
And they all have, you know, similar chemical characteristics. So the point I'm making is most of those crops, like peppers, for example, and tomatoes would be anti-inflammatory. But if you're sensitive to those particular foods, you could have a pro-inflammatory reaction that is problematic and not consistent with what other people eating those same foods would have. So in that case, you need to understand your own biology and, you know, your experience with food to know. I like eggplant and I'll have a little bit of baba ganoush and stuff, but I would never eat like eggplant parmesan. That would
be I was going to say the eggplant's pretty popular in Indian food. So I wondered and I think it originated from there. We did on one of our podcasts, we talked a little bit about eggplant and I think the origin of it is somewhere in India, but yeah, baba ganoush, that's some good stuff. Okay. Well,
so I'm not making you ratatouille when you come to my home.
Oh, please don't.
She's got a great recipe for ratatouille. She shared.
I can have a little bit. I can have a little homeopathic dose.
Yeah. And there's so many different varieties of eggplant. I mean, just hundreds, if not thousands, but we looked into that a little bit. So
I could probably eat 50 grams a day and it probably would be fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any one food that everybody should avoid?
Well, ultra processed foods as a category that, mm-hmm. yeah, they should be on the off list for sure. Cause there's not a single ultra processed food that's particularly good for you. They're all pro-inflammatory and they're all, you know, they're not a good value in terms of cost per unit nutrient for sure. They're just, yeah, those should definitely be avoided. And of course, they represent the biggest part of the food marketplace.
I've noticed in what you have written and spoken about that you are careful to distinguish between acute inflammation and chronic inflammation. Can you elaborate on the difference?
The way the immune system gets turned on and off is through these intercellular messengers. So these are chemicals that communicate between cells. So you get this initial response. These chemicals go out, they recruit cells of the immune system to come to the site of the trouble. And then they in turn produce some of the same chemicals and other ones that countervail their effect. So the property of any good competent biological system, and I would say probably social systems as well, is negative feedback is the desirable state. So what you want is, you know, if your cholesterol would be a good example of that, you need to have cholesterol to live, right? If you don't have cholesterol, you won't be able to, you know, make cell membrane and all kinds of stuff, but too much of it is a bad thing. So what you want is a system that will make the right amount of cholesterol. So you make cholesterol up to a certain point, then you get to that point and the signal should go back to the control tower to say, stop making cholesterol. The same thing applies here. So these neutrophils and other cells go out, and once things start getting resolved, they should be sending out negative feedback signals. So IL-6 is a pro-inflammatory cytokine. You'd want an anti-inflammatory cytokine to be produced at the site where the trouble is getting resolved in order to turn off the signals. So basically there's this, and I used to think it was pretty simple. It actually isn't very simple, but you want the acute process to turn off appropriately. And when it doesn't, if the pro-inflammatory cytokines continue being produced and they're not being countervailed by the anti-inflammatory cytokines, you enter into a state of chronic systemic inflammation. And unlike acute inflammation, which typically gets resolved in a matter of days or hours, chronic systemic and tissue-specific simmering inflammation can go on for decades, you know, literally for people's entire lives. And you can see people, you can see people in the society, because we have a lot of obesity here, who are, you know, obviously in musculoskeletal pain. And it's because they're in a state of chronic systemic inflammation. And some of this is systemic and it affects, you know, the circulatory system, the heart and so forth. And some of it is what I referred to, and that is tissue or organ specific simmering inflammation. A good example of that would be knee osteoarthritis, for example.
Interesting. Yeah. I love the way you're able to take such high level scientific, complicated, complex information and find ways to creatively share it with us lay people that makes sense. And what I want our listeners to know, and maybe you talk a little bit about, is that, you know, your work is based in solid scientific research. You know, and in your intro, we talked about all the grants that and the research grants that you've been given and the peer-reviewed papers. Can you tell our listeners why this is important and why you emphasize that aspect?
Well, the scientific method is really important in telling us that something works. It's also potentially very important to tell us how something works, but knowing that something works is really crucial. So a really good example I'll give is, you know, I think the first in the West, the first, and it may be true anywhere in the world, the first clinical or randomized trial of an agent to produce or to prevent a disease was done by Lind for the Royal Navy in 1754.
You're referencing James Lind, the Scottish doctor, is that correct?
Yeah, and that's where the word Limeys comes from. So they were noticing these sailors on really long voyages. So these people would go out on ships for years at a time and they would develop scurvy. They went, what the hell? This is really bad. You know, scurvy means you're basically all the connective tissue in your body falls apart. Your teeth fall out. I mean, this is not good. You know, you want a fighting force. You want people to be healthy. Then they're literally falling apart on you. So he did this study showing that limes in particular, but, you know, it could be lemons. It could be any vitamin-rich food would prevent scurvy. So we knew that in the mid-18th century. But we didn't know what vitamin C was until the 20th century. Uh-huh. So we knew that it worked long before we knew how it worked. And there's a thing called the criteria for judging causality that was developed by Bradford Hill, who worked with Sir Richard Dahl, who published his paper on smoking and lung cancer, basically the same month that Ernie Winder, my boss in New York, did. And he's probably one of the greatest minds of the 20th century in terms of applying epidemiologic principles to understanding how things work. And if a relationship's causal, it's called the criteria for judging causality. It was popularized in the 1964 Surgeon General's report on smoking and health. And it's a really important way of looking at evidence. And so to answer your question, Edwin, this really centers on understanding what the evidence is and then basing recommendations on the evidence. So evidence-based, you know, information. Right. So if you don't have the science and you don't understand what the hell's going on, you know, you're lost.
Right.
You had mentioned the example of cholesterol. So I have high cholesterol. Mm-hmm. I've always had high cholesterol, even like in college. So can some numbers be ethnically specific? 200 being the average person is the number that the doctors shoot for, but I'm half Japanese. Uh-huh. And maybe if I could cut off a limb or something like that, I could get to 200, but, but it,
don't do that.
So part of it's diet related, but are some ethnicities higher than
more prone to cholesterol?
Yes. Yeah. Because they did do a picture, because my doctor was just like, okay, I'm done fooling around with you. She goes, I want like the x-ray of you, or, and it came up zero.
Okay. So what I will say, I'm not a cardiologist, but I've done work with cardiologists, and I know a lot about serum lipids, and I don't want to go too far in that direction, because right, serum lipids is related to inflammation, but it's not, it's a whole other topic area. But there are populations in the world that I would call metabolically obese. Some of them are in East Asia. So many of them are in South Asia. So South in people from India, who I work with a lot, they tend to have a phenotype, which expresses what we're talking about. They'll tend to run really high cholesterol levels and really low HDL. So I don't know what you're—
That's eating. Mine. The good cholesterol is really, really high, and the other one's still high. So you add them together, and then you get a really big number.
You're in good shape. Well, better shape. So these South Asians I work with, and also my ethnicity, which is French Canadian and Canadian Indian, they tend to be metabolically obese. So they express a phenotype where they have high cholesterol level and low HDL. That's bad. But I don't. I mean, I don't have that gene. So, you know, for me, it's not an issue. So there's a lot of genetic control here, but there's also a lot of potential for diet to control. So when we did the Worcester area trial for counseling and hyperlipidemia back in the 1990s, we found that diet intervention in these hyperlipidemic people— this is a randomized trial, and I don't want to get too far into that, but we showed that the effect of a diet intervention— it was very low grade intervention. It was just 1 hour, one-on-one, 2 1-hour sessions, group sessions, or they might've been 2 2-hour sessions, I think they were. And then one individual session at the end. We found that people that went to at least 3 sessions had a cholesterol lowering effect as large as the statins.
So when you say metabolically obese, that means...
What I will explain what that means. What it
Thank
means
you.
Is for somebody's metabolically obese, they express symptoms associated with obesity at lower levels of adiposity. It doesn't take as much fat tissue in those groups to make trouble. Now, there's a silver lining in that, you know, you can also get a good response in that group by lowering the signal. So we showed that in African Americans here in South Carolina, we could produce a relatively larger effect in terms of lowering central adiposity, in turn reducing the level of inflammatory biomarkers.
But that doesn't necessarily mean the scale obesity.
Yeah, that's a good question. So when medical and public health people talk about obesity, what they're talking about is weight for height. It's expressed as body mass index, which is in kilograms divided by height in meters squared. When kinesiologists and physiologists talk about obesity, they're talking about adiposity, right? And it is adiposity that matters, not obesity.
For our listeners' sake, adiposity is the condition of having too much fatty tissues in the body.
And I'll give you an extreme example, and it's, you know, but it's striking. You can have an NFL linebacker, right, who may have a BMI of 40 and body fat at 6%. Now that's unusual. You know, normally people with a BMI of 40 are going to have 40% or more, you know, weight as adipose tissue. But there are people that are, you know, obese by that metric who don't have much adipose tissue. And it's the adipose tissue that matters. Some people are more sensitive to it than others, but it is the adipose tissue. It isn't, you know, lean body mass is good for you. And there's a big literature on that.
So that's interesting. Yeah. And it probably would have to be a linebacker, NFL linebacker, to have that kind of ratio.
Yeah. You know, it's an absurd example, but it's real. And it just shows that it's important to be clear about what you mean when you say what you say.
Yeah. That's a good point. I hadn't thought about those issues. Yeah.
What is the intervention that you did with these groups to lower their cholesterol?
It was a simple diet intervention. We're getting to eat, you know, more whole foods, more whole grains, fruits and vegetables, and to displace the and we can talk about later about displacement, but you know, to displace the ultra processed foods with those things. So you put them into the mix and it just pushes these other foods out, which is good.
Yeah. Well, as you know, that's our focus here at Produce Buzz, is to encourage people to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables. And why we're so happy to have you on the podcast today, because all of your research and expertise hopefully will encourage them and inspire them. Why are fruits and vegetables so good for fighting inflammation?
Well, that is a great question. And it's because they contain these phytochemicals, these chemicals that exist in plants, these polyphenolic compounds that are, you know, flavanols and carotenoids and different compounds that are very strongly anti-inflammatory. And in general, I may be anticipating another question here, but in general, those foods which are the most anti-inflammatory tend to be the most colorful. So for example, among fruits, things like blueberries and blackberries would be the more anti-inflammatory. Among vegetables, it would be dark green vegetables and dark pigmented, you know, orange vegetables and so forth. Those are the ones that are going to be the most anti-inflammatory. So it's really about, you know, if you think about it, it's two things. It's the appearance that I mentioned, but it's also flavor and taste. So those compounds also impart taste. So they're not bland. Let's
put it that way. Right. Yeah. We on our, you know, we try to feature different fruits and vegetables, tell people about them. And we always go into their health benefits, and those phytochemicals keep coming up in our discussions. And we, even in one of our most recent podcasts, we talked about eating the rainbow, you know, and more colorful your plate is, probably the more healthy it is, unless it's Skittles or M&M's.
Hey.
Natural colors.
Right. So, you know, study after study has shown that only a small percentage of Americans and even around the world eat enough fruits and veggies. I think that the vast majority of people and our listeners know that eating more fresh fruits and vegetables can have a very positive effect on their health. But why do you think so few of them get the recommended servings?
Well, I a lot of it's experiential. I think that I compare the world as it existed when I was young, you know, when we were gardening, and it's really a very different place. I mean, these were the years right after World War II, and, you know, ultra processed foods were coming on the market, but they hadn't, you know, achieved dominance at that point. And I think people just forget. I think there's cultural amnesia. That's part of what's going on. I think part of it is also neophobia, which is a fear of, you know, new tastes and flavors. And we can do a better job of introducing people to these flavors. So one of the things I'll tell people all the time is just rephrasing what I said before, and that is that those foods that are anti-inflammatory, they're colorful, but they're also flavorful. And that's just looking at it from the whole food perspective. Any spice that you name, you know, cardamom, cinnamon, ginger, or things like the allium vegetables like garlic and leek and onion and stuff that have strong taste, they're all strongly anti-inflammatory. So we were working with a company called Fruzers that made frozen food snacks for whole food, frozen fruit snacks for kids. And they were scoring C on our scale. So from A to F, so C wasn't so wonderful. And what we said was, you got to do two things. You got to get rid of some of the banana, replace it with more highly pigmented fruits. And they said, well, but what about the flavor profile? And I said, well, you can try cardamom. And they did. They put in a little bit of cardamom. They got it up to an A, and the kids just loved it. an increased palatability. So I think people need to start feeling comfortable playing with flavor and taste. I think that's key in all this. It's experiential. And the other thing that drives me a bit crazy is, you know, we talk about food being cheap, which it is. Food's cheap in the United States, but it's cheap in terms of the amount of money you spend per calorie. It's not cheap when you consider the amount of money spent per nutrient.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The flavor and taste, it's hard for some of the fruits and vegetables to compete against the highly engineered Dorito, which, you know, that's very important point you bring up, that people need to experiment and get over their neophobia, try new things to improve their health and retrain their palates. And I know that's something you've been working on with through Qi and DII, our flavor profiles, taste profiles. I'm not sure if I'm calling it the same thing. Talk about what you're doing there, and maybe can we give some hints and suggestions to our listeners to expand or refine their flavor profiles?
I think this is a real frontier area. So, you know, I worked for a while with a woman at the Monell Chemical Senses Center or something like that. It's in Philadelphia. And I was amazed at what they don't know about, you know, the connection between, you know, nutritional value of food, for example, and how people perceive flavor. So I think this is a real frontier area. It's complicated in a number of ways, including the fact that people's perceptions, there's a lot of interpersonal variability in perception, and perception changes during the life course. So, you know, pregnant women will tell you, well, this doesn't taste at all like it used to taste. And when they stop being pregnant, it'll start tasting like it used to taste. Sometimes they'll, and now with this COVID-19 business going on and, you know, people losing the taste of sense of, especially smell, a little bit taste, right, but mainly smell. It's really complicated stuff, but I think this is key because it is that primal experience of, and I'm going to use these terms kind of interchangeably here, but they're quite different from one another, flavor and taste, that drives people to eat what they're going to eat. Some people are very conscious about cost, and some people are really conscious about animal rights issues and stuff like that. But really, it's the aesthetic pleasure of eating that gets people to eat. So I think this is a frontier area, and I'm no expert at it.
Yeah. But how many people say their parents boiled the hell out of fill in the blank? So broccoli was mush. Those people now are adults. And if they didn't have a parent that knew how to manage said fruit or vegetable, then that's kind of a challenge because now they're feeding another generation.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I told you about the experience of having a garden growing up. My mother, we had three different pressure cookers. We had the canning pressure cooker. We had another big pressure cooker and a smaller. My mother loved the pressure cooker. And she would make what she called these New England boiled dinners. And she would take all these, she just chuck these vegetables from our garden, which were crispy and wonderful and nice, and she just pressure cook them. So but I learned very early, taste of those things, first of all, it wasn't always bad. You know, there were some nice things that came out of the pressure cooker, but I understood that the kinds of tastes that you'd get from these vegetables fresh versus cooked were quite different to one another. So I knew that going in. And what you're saying is most people wouldn't know that going in. So, yeah, it's like what we were just talking about. You need to reorient people towards these experiences.
I worked with a grower, one of the largest growers of tomatoes in California and Florida. It was his opinion. People don't know what a tomato is supposed to taste like.
Yeah, of course. So some of its varieties that are grown for commercial purposes, so they ship well and they keep well and all that stuff. And then some of it is just, you know, what you do in terms of processing and how quickly you eat it. So I go into the garden, I just eat things. You know, I eat the tomatoes, I eat the green beans, and They're just a completely different experience, right straight from the garden.
Can I ask a question? Inflammation in relation to the COVID virus and how diet could affect the symptoms of COVID itself?
Well, there was a position paper that was published in Clinical Nutrition by ESPEN, which is what the European Society for, I can't remember the rest of it, N stands for nutrition, and I think P is prevention, but they came out with a statement based on the research, stating clearly that there seemed to be a really strong effect of diet in terms of disease course and getting people out of the ICU and so forth. I think the more important area is the ability of diet to prevent infection in the first place and also to reduce mortality. So we have access to the UK Biobank data, which is the largest prospective study in the world. And I can't go into many details here because we're just in the process of writing up the, you know, doing the results and writing up the paper. But there's a really strong and consistent association between DII score and incidence of disease.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
So that as DII score goes up, incidence of disease goes up. And it's very, very monotonic, very linear. The worse your diet is, the more likely it is you're going to get COVID-19. And this is a prospective study. So there's nothing, no issue with, you know, retrospective dietary assessment and so forth.
Are you also doing research to the effect of Alzheimer's?
We've done a bunch of studies looking at cognitive decline, and there's a really strong relationship with cognitive decline and frailty. The problem with Alzheimer's disease is you can't get a definitive diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease without an autopsy.
Right. But cognitive decline, can see that. Then you just don't know if it's Alzheimer's that's causing it or not. But
yeah, and it almost doesn't matter, you know.
Right,
you,
right. It's a good point.
You know, call it whatever you want. You're having cognitive decline. You don't know what, you know, you're losing your marbles. And it doesnn't matter what the, in a certain sense, it gets back to what I said before about knowing, you know, how it works versus if it works. I mean, so you have these plaques in your brain and you're getting demented, or you don't have plaques in your brain, or you don't know. But you're still getting demented.
Right, right. Yeah, and with so many of the fruits and vegetables, when we look at the studies surrounding them, you know, mental health and, you know, the boost to your cognitive powers, it seems like almost all of them have some effect, or there's been studies that have shown that they have effect. You have a new book coming out, which we talked, well, we mentioned in the intro. I believe it's a collaborative effort. You've written quite a bit of it, but you have some other colleagues who've contributed to it. And it delves into inflammation and I think in a broad way, but also comprehensive and delves into some comprehensive aspects as well. Tell us about it and maybe what you learned putting it together and, when will it be out, all of that.
Well, I'd like to know when it's going to be out, because as far as I'm concerned, it's done. I proofed all the chapters, and I don't know what else is doing. They're the largest scientific publisher in the world, so presumably they'll get it together and publish the damn thing. It should be coming out soon.
Right.
It consists of 17 chapters. In the first chapters, it gives a history of inflammation and the history of nutrition. It talks about acute versus chronic inflammation. It talks about the switching system, which is between acute and chronic, which is very dependent on omega-3 fatty acids. So these are the fatty acids that, for example, exist in some vegetables and fruits, but also in fish who eat phytoplankton. That's where it's coming from, in the ocean. Right.
And lots of nuts too, which we don't discriminate against nuts and mushrooms and other things. We can talk about them as well. But
So that's the first part of the book. Then I've got a chapter looking at how we evaluate evidence, where we get the data from and how we evaluate evidence. Then the middle section of the book talks about diseases, all the itises, you know, any word that ends in itis is an inflammation related condition. So arthritis, bursitis, gingivitis, diverticulitis, meningitis, hepatitis, all the itises.
Oh, wow.
And some things that aren't itises, like multiple sclerosis. And then metabolic diseases like type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, cancer, aging, conditions related to pregnancy and childhood, the microbiome, chronobiology, and then we review the 40 most popular diets that were reviewed by U.S. News and World Report. So there's some interesting surprises there. And then we, in the final chapter, we kind of bring it all together and talk about where the frontier areas are. And one of them is what we talked about before in terms of understanding taste and flavor and so forth, but also talking about global warming as it relates to all this, and well, global climate change is more accurate because it isn't always just global warming.
Yeah, interesting. Well, that's great. And I know that's maybe a bit more of an academic book, but it's there's a lot of, there should be a lot of information in there that could be valuable for anyone if they can get access to it. Hopefully that can happen. And
you can get it. There's an Elsevier subsite on what do you call it? Amazon.
Okay, great.
So when it comes out, it'll be, you can get it on Amazon. You can
So it's not restricted to the academic world.
No, not
very
at all.
Good.
No, my guess is that, you know, smart people will find it accessible. I mean, I don't think it's written in, you know, there's some jargon in there, but when there's jargon, it's in there for a purpose. And the other thing I'll say, which is really important to the question you asked, because I didn't answer that part of the question, what did I learn?
Oh, right.
I had no bloody idea how far back in time biologically these systems went. And it turns out about 45% of our innate immune system and the inflammatory response is shared between animals and plants. And animals and plants diverged in their biological history, evolution, between 1.2 and 1.8 billion years ago. I had no idea.
That's fascinating.
And that took me down several rabbit holes that were extraordinarily interesting.
Right, well, very good. Well, you, on your website, which is, I'm going to tell our listeners, they can go and visit. It's chi-llc.net. chi-llc.net. Go and check it out. And you can read a little bit more about what they are working on at Connecting Health Innovations. And but on that website, you ask people to join the cause and help you revolutionize health. Tell us about that grand vision and what we can do to assist you, and our listeners can do to join in.
Well, I think that the primary experience of eating and feeling the salubrious effects, the good effects on health of the food, gets people motivated. I think that once you've had this experience, you will get motivated and you'll want to change, and you want to, you know, convince other people to change, and you want to change systems so that they support this healthful way of doing things. So that's really where I'm coming from. I believe in the basic goodness of this, and that it will, you know, essentially all work out if people just have the experience of it, which isn't the book learning part of it. It's actually the, like I said, right at the beginning, I got healthier. I healed more quickly at the end of the summer. And I never understood that for many decades, I didn't understand that. And then I started putting two and two together. I went, oh yeah, that's what's going on.
So that's a great point. So
how much would you attribute vitamin D from the sunshine?
Some, and I think that gets into a really interesting public health issue, because we're so obsessed with skin cancer that people aren't outside much anyway, right? But when they do go out, they may go out for long bouts, and they're likely to get, you know, sunburned, especially light skinned people. So I think it was important to be out in the sunshine, frankly. And it was very healthy, and I didn't get sunburned. I mean, I would be out all day long. And I mean, I might get a sunburn at the very beginning of the summer, but that would be I'd learn my lesson and I'd just, you know, build up gradually. And then after that, my skin just got darker.
Well, back to your vision of revolutionizing health and us joining in, I think one of the things we had Dr. Brian Asbill as a guest recently, who you know, in fact, you introduced me to him. And, you know, one of the things he's learning in his practice of cardiology rehab is the crucial importance of having a community around you to support you in these changes. So I think that's another thing that I see you alluding to, not just alluding to, but specifying as key. Joining forces, joining the cause, and getting people around you to support you. And we are trying to do that with Produce Buzz to get people to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables and develop a loyal following here to keep encouraging them. Well, any other Produce Buzzers have any more questions for Dr. Hebert? We should probably let him get on his way to India.
I would like to ask one more, at least. When it comes to supplements, do you believe in getting all of your nutrients through food, or do you take some supplements as well?
It depends. At certain times of year, I might take some vitamin D. If I have an injury, I might take vitamin C and vitamin E, which are really good for, repairing collagen. So I've had a lot of injuries in my life, and I know how to heal them quickly. So vitamin C, mega dosing vitamin C and vitamin E at those times can be extraordinarily helpful. And I've got good stories about that, but I don't want to spend time on the stories right now. But
now,
this vitamin C's known role in metabolism, it gets back to what I was saying about the scurvy story, is in making collagen. So proline hydroxylase. And without vitamin C, you can't make collagen. And you do a really good job of making connective tissue if you have a lot of vitamin C at the time, around the time of the injury. So those are things I'd consider taking. If I eat a very vegan type diet, possibly B12. My daughter got into trouble. She eats fish, but she got into trouble in Denmark with B12 and D. So she takes those supplements and is much better off now. But in general, two things about supplements. First of all, every single one of them is anti-inflammatory, just about, almost all. And I told that to my colleague at Nestle, and I could see she was lighting up. She said, oh, we can just supplement. I said, no, the problem with that is when you supplement, you don't displace. You're just adding to what you already have. What you really want to do is displace this ultra-processed food, which is strongly pro-inflammatory, with fresh fruits and vegetables. And you can eat a lot of fruits and vegetables without eating a lot of calories. So a lot of people are worried about weight control. Well, this is a great way to do it. Just eat ad libitum fruits and vegetables and you'll be fine. And it's a much better strategy in general than taking supplements and continuing to eat a crappy diet.
Well, that's a very good point. Very good point.
You had mentioned diet and cancer. I have two friends who are dealing with cancer right now. Both of their medical people said sugar feeds cancer.
Oh, absolutely.
Why? Can you give me an explanation?
It gets back to this, to the signaling I was talking about before. So I was talking about cytokine signaling in relation to inflammatory markers. And it does. It will turn on and off those as well. So people with metabolic dysfunction, people, you know, with type 2 diabetes or, you know, metabolic disease are going to have this problem inevitably. But there's a thing called insulin-like growth factor. And insulin-like growth factor is really strongly related to many of these epithelial cancers, which are the most common solid tumors, like breast cancer and prostate cancer and colorectal cancer and so forth. So yeah, the sugar definitely feeds the cancer. It would be really good not to eat a lot of sugar. And that raises a really interesting point about fruits versus vegetables. So the evidence linking vegetables to cancer prevention is much stronger than fruits.
Because of the extra sugar in the fruits.
Yeah, in general.
Even though they're complex carbohydrates.
Okay. I mean, they're much better than ultra-processed foods, but the evidence for vegetables is stronger than for fruits. Yeah. And then among the fruits, remember what I said about that bar, they replaced some banana with those berries and the cardamom, and they got the anti-inflammatory effect to be much lower. So,
okay.
Yeah. If you are eating fruits, you can be strategic about which ones you eat.
Right. Very good.
Are there any healthy sweeteners?
Well, this is a really interesting question. So I make this masala chai, and I think I gave Edwin the recipe of it to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has a bit of honey in it. And the sweetness, the amount of sweetness it has is about 1/7 that of either sweet tea or Coke, you know, something like that, Coke or Pepsi. And yet it tastes sweet. And the reason why, and it gets back to this taste business we were talking about, the reason why is because those spices that are in there, the cardamom, the nutmeg, the cinnamon, the clove, the ginger, they amplify the apparent effect of the sweetness. Yeah. Now, I told that to my colleague in Philadelphia, and she said I was crazy. And I said, no, I'm not crazy. I'm perceiving it. You can't tell me why I'm perceiving it that way, but I know I'm perceiving it that way. And also, I will say, and this is a taste preference issue, I've made it with stevia. And it's bloody awful with stevia, except if you have it cold in the summertime. And then it's brilliant. So that's weird, you know, but in general, the less sweet, the better. But again, you'll acclimate. I remember when I was a little kid, we used to have whole milk. The cream would be at the top and you have to shake the living daylights out of it. And that's what we grew up until my mom went to work when I was 12 years old. And then we started drinking 2% milk and then 1% milk. And I don't drink milk anymore, but if I were to drink whole milk, it would just taste awful. And you know, I loved it at the time. You know, it just shows you how you get acclimated to different
things. Right. Things can be so rich. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
I ask one more question.
I'm okay if Dr. Hebert has the time.
Just one more question. Okay.
How do you rate turmeric?
How do I do what?
How do you rate turmeric as far as reducing inflammation?
Oh, well, if you look at the evidence on turmeric and curcumin is probably best of any spice. I mean, there's a huge literature on this. So I think turmeric is a really good food item. When I put it in my chai, I put it in lots of other things. And when I put it in chai or I cook with it, I make sure that I have black pepper at the same time, because that makes it more bioavailable. So that's another really important thing about combining foods, because sometimes when you're combining foods, often when you're combining foods, the bioavailability changes.
That's an interesting subject. I would love to have you come back.
Is that covered in your book that's going to be out?
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen some articles, I won't say research, but articles about that, how foods help one another be absorbed in the body. That would be a fascinating episode for us, but
yeah, we can do it later.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well, thank you so much. Such a pleasure to have you, see you again and talk to you again. And thank you for sharing your knowledge, wisdom, and great stories with our listeners.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Cheers.
Safe travels.
Cheers. Yes.
Have a great trip.
Let us know how you're doing.
Will do.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed our conversation today with Dr. Hebert. What a delight to have him on and hear all about his experience with diet and inflammation and other diseases. And we hope that the conversation inspires you to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables. They are a powerful weapon to fight off inflammation and lots of other chronic diseases.
Please take a second before you leave to subscribe and or follow our podcast on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. We are on over 10 different podcast feeds, including YouTube. And if you want to help support this podcast by making a donation, we would be so grateful. Just go to anchor.fm/produce-buzz, and you will see a support button below the podcast description. Click on it, give what you can. No amount is too small, and, of course, no amount is too large. Thank you, listeners, and good night.
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the Produce Buzzers podcast, brought to you by Produce Buzz.
the gathering place for lovers of fresh fruits and veggies. We hope you were entertained a bit and educated a lot about fresh produce. Be sure to join us next time, and please tell your friends to do so as well. Like, share, and comment on our Produce Buzz Facebook page. And check out our website at www.producebuzz.com. There you will find articles about fresh fruits and veggies, how to select, store, and prepare them, as well as lots of interesting facts about all the wonderful bounty the earth provides for us. Until next time, be fruitful, and don't forget to veg out.